Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Well, it is just 12 days before Election Day. Kind of hard to believe. In just 12 days, Americans will go to the polls for the first time since 1996 to freely elect the President of the United States. We all know in 2000 the election results weren't counted. The Supreme Court decided that they were going to determine who our president was. As they cited in their opinion, it was due to the incompetence of Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris. Her failure to determine adequate standards for Florida meant that they were just going to decide the election themselves. But now, in 12 days, for the first time in 8 years, perhaps this time, the American people will actually get to choose who is president of the United States. And the election is neck and neck. I do believe Kerry's going to win, but I also think it is extremely close. And starting today and on through Election Day, I'll be giving my predictions of the electoral vote count. I know that's a risky thing to do, but hey, I predicted not just a Kerry win, but a Red Sox victory. And already Nathan, one of my bloggers, writes, "Mark, good call on Boston beating the Yankees. I'll admit I thought you were crazy. I can only hope your prediction of Kerry winning doesn't hold true." Well, Nathan, I predict the Red Sox will go on to victory in the World Series and that Kerry will win a fairly close victory. Here's my electoral vote count. I predict that Kerry will probably win all of the states that Gore won in 2000, as well as the state of New Hampshire, which gives him 264 electoral votes. And I also predict he will win either Ohio or Florida and thus become President of the United States. If the election were held today, I predict he would win Ohio, but not Florida. We've talked about all the things that they're doing in Florida to try to prevent Democrats from voting. I think probably those will succeed if the election were held today. Kerry would win Ohio, but not Florida. He might also lose Wisconsin. That's a state that Gore won. And even if he loses Wisconsin and doesn't win New Hampshire, if he wins all the Gore states plus Ohio, minus Wisconsin, that gives him exactly 270 electoral votes, just enough he needs to eke out a victory. And I'll be giving the state of the electoral vote count based on all the polls, which I read, each day from now until Election Day. But the race is essentially tied. It is very, very close. I do admit it could go either way, though I think the uncommitted at the end will break to Kerry, as they often do to a challenger. But it wasn't always that way. We can remember back in August when John Kerry was well ahead in the polls, both in the popular vote and the electoral vote count. And then came the Swift Boat ads. Karl Rove did what he does best. He took a place where Kerry was absolutely solid, where he was strongest, his Vietnam service, his heroic medals, and he attacked him right at that spot. Now, this is a place where Kerry thought he was invulnerable. After all, many Democrats chose Kerry precisely because of his Vietnam service. Kerry had emphasized it many times. But Karl Rove has shown a really canny political sense. Karl Rove, of course, is George Bush's political guru. Karl Rove has shown an incredible sense for going right after the strongest part of a candidate's record. In one race, there was a candidate who was well known for all the work he did with children. He was incredible with helping children all across the local area where he was, well known for helping in schools, helping with mentoring programs, and so forth. So Karl Rove let loose the rumor that this man was somehow involved in pedophilia. What a clever rumor. Now all of this man's good works with kids was down the drain because every time they showed him with kids, people were thinking, pedophilia. And even though Karl Rove never stood behind his claim of pedophilia and there was no evidence for it, this was enough to bring the man's candidacy down. Well, the same they did with John Kerry. They went after him where he was strongest, the medals he won in Vietnam, and John O'Neill, a guy hired originally by Richard Nixon to combat John Kerry in 1971, has been going on air with his Unfit for Command book talking about how John Kerry didn't deserve his medals. At the end of tonight's broadcast, I want to play at length from a Nightline broadcast. If you didn't hear it, it was an extraordinary thing where Nightline actually went to Vietnam, interviewed actual Vietnamese who saw the battle, and showed that Kerry and the after-action naval reports are all correct, while John O'Neill, perhaps to no one's surprise, is lying. What's most interesting, I think, is the interview at the end between Ted Koppel and John O'Neill, where you can hear really an uncomfortable interview as Ted Koppel confronts John O'Neill over some of his lies. That's at the second half of the hour. The first half of the hour, though, we go back to where George Bush was during Vietnam. As reported on this program way back in February, there are all kinds of questions about George Bush, whether or not, as has been reported, that he was doing cocaine, whether he was on drugs, whether he couldn't fly for that reason. And new evidence has come out. You see, despite the fact that Bush claims he turned over all his National Guard records, they tried a second time to turn some over, and then they said they were all done, and then they turned over a third time, and then they said they were all done. Now a fourth set of records has been disclosed. I don't think they're even claiming that they've all been turned over this time. And there is a designation on one of them that we're going to discuss in just a minute that suggests that George Bush's discharge was none too honorable. My guest is Russ Baker of The Nation magazine, and he has reported on this at length. And also, I want to note that on my website, if you click where it says click here, you can go to some of the nice work that Democrats.com is doing and Paul Lukasik's, I hope I pronounced his name right, are doing on this. The point is, this is still new evidence coming out. And I know a lot of you are saying, why are we still busy about Vietnam? The point is, we are still getting new evidence because Bush has been hiding evidence about what he was doing in Vietnam, just as we're finding new evidence about John Kerry. So I want to take today, this hour, one last look at Vietnam. If you want to call in and ask a question of myself or my guest, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can contribute to the blog, as many of you already have, just by going to www.radioinsidescoop.com. First, let me welcome my guest, Russ Baker, to the Inside Scoop. Russ, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell me the research that you've been doing on George Bush and where he was some 30-odd years ago.
Well, let me step back for a moment, if I might, and just say that it's important to contextualize why it even matters where he was 30 years ago.
I agree.
And I think you've set the stage nicely. It matters in part because they made it matter what Kerry was doing then. It also matters because, of course, that was a significant period in our country's history. It's also important because George Bush has basically defined himself to voters as the commander-in-chief. He has asked people to vote for him based on his strength of character and his leadership in a time of war. And so, obviously, if we look at how he comported himself in a time of war, that has a lot of relevancy. Now,
Let me just say this. I think one reason why it's relevant is because people are often comparing the war in Iraq with the war in Vietnam. And I have to say there's a big difference between the war in Iraq and the war in Vietnam. George Bush had an exit strategy for the Vietnam War.
Yes, he did. He did.
Tell us about that.
I also want to say that actually I sort of got into looking at Bush's guard record almost by accident because, in fact, as I was just trying to understand who this man was, it's important to remember that we really know almost nothing about this man. And I don't just mean during that period, but I mean about his entire life. We really don't know much about anything. We don't know really anything about his businesses. We do know that they presented them as successful ventures when, in fact, they lost money for the investors, made money only for him. We know that he claims to have been the head of a Major League Baseball team, but there are real questions about that. There are questions about his governorship. And so really every aspect of his life is subject to question. But getting to the guard situation, there you have a guy who, when he was at Yale, 1968, he was an avid proponent of the Vietnam War, and he would criticize fellow students who were against the war, and he said that they were not patriotic and that he intended to do the right thing. And, of course, what the right thing became, not going to Vietnam, but getting in ahead of a long waiting list for a coveted slot in a safe stateside Texas Air National Guard unit. And he got into this unit, as they say, because of who his father was. And once he was in the unit, he did his training, as far as we can tell, for the first couple of years, first two, three, even 4 years, he did his flying. And what happened was once he was finished with his full-time flight training. That really was kind of round-the-clock service. He went into what they call the weekend warrior status. And the weekend warrior status is you're basically like a civilian, but you're obligated to show up one weekend a month and do your drills. Plus, you have to go up in a plane and log enough hours to show that you're still able to handle the controls. And he did that for a while. And then sometime early in 1972, strange things began to happen. And we know this because, as you said, the White House has been very, very reticent to release records. But a lawsuit by the Associated Press pried out some new records which showed that in early 1972, he began having some kind of problem flying his plane. And what it shows, essentially, is that he went from flying a one-seater F-102A fighter plane to being in a two-seater training plane where you've got essentially a teacher sitting behind you with a duplicate set of controls.
So let me just make this clear. So he was flying solo in the early part of his career, and then his 1972 approach, he kind of went backwards. He went from flying solo to flying with someone by his side who could take over the plane in case he messed up.
That's correct.
All right, keep going.
So that's the first interesting thing.
Now, how do we know this? Let me make it clear that we have the documents, we have the records. How do we know
those
this to be true?
Those are official documents that were released by the White House, or by the government, rather, in response to a lawsuit from the Associated Press.
Okay.
Those are flight logs.
Where can somebody find those flight logs?
Let's see. Probably you had mentioned that Democrats.com. I think they post all of these things.
Okay. So let me
Paul
just say.
Paul Lukasiak. I think it's, what is that, BushAWOL.com or something?
Those are good sites. And I link to one of those on my website, folks. You can go there and check it out. But keep going, Russ.
So anyway, that stuff. But you know, even before those came out, we knew that something appeared to be wrong with his service because in May 1972, he took off from his unit in Texas. And he headed to Alabama. Now, you can do that. Again, you're largely a civilian at that point. He still had 2 years left on his contract, and he had to continue flying. But you were allowed, within reason, to ask your commanders to say, hey, you know, I've got a job in another place. I need to go there. And what they do is they basically allow you to transfer, and then you hook up with a unit in the new place. Well, what he did, as we found by examining the document trail, is he went to Alabama, but he didn't serve again. Now, he claims that he has. He says he doesn't remember the details. But in fact, there is no paper trail to show that he did any service. And in fact, the commanding officers in Alabama say that he never showed up. And they even put out rewards, substantial rewards, and not a single credible airman from all of those units in Alabama, including probably the majority who support Bush, has ever come forward to say that they remember him.
I should note the rewards are now at $50,000. So if any of you know someone who knew Bush and the Guard, here's their chance to make a bunch of money. I do think someone would have claimed reward by now if someone did exist.
Exactly. And in fact, the only real evidence that he was ever on a base is a record of a visit to a dentist early January 1973. Now, I've got my theory about that, and I'll tell you what that is based on my reporting. What he did was he went to Alabama, and he told his officers in Texas, the official reason was he was going to Alabama because he was going to, quote, manage a campaign. This was a senatorial campaign for a guy named Winton Blunt, who was a friend of his father's and a friend of Nixon's. The only problem is when I started studying that and interviewing people who had been involved with the campaign, it became very, very clear that not only was he not a campaign manager, he was not even a very responsible low-level member of the staff. He actually typically would show up in the afternoon hours for the campaign, which anyone who's worked on a campaign knows that's a total no-no. Show up in the afternoon hours, and then he'd put his feet up on a desk, and he'd start bragging about how trashed he'd gotten the night before. Anyway, he had a very unimpressive record there. People told me that they often had no idea where he was for days at a time, and whatever it was that he was doing, it wasn't very important. But we do know then that around Christmas time, he went back to have their annual family holiday gathering. And right after that, he flew. He was basically finished with Alabama. The campaign was over. He flew back to Alabama, and he went to the dentist there. Now, why would you fly to Alabama and go to the dentist and then go back to Texas?
So we're clear, I mean, he's from Texas, so most of us have dentists in our hometowns, not in some other place.
Right, right. And in fact, he was with his family in Washington and then in Florida. If he had a problem with his tooth, he could have gone to a dentist there. But my surmise, and I think this is a reasonable one, is that his father, a very, very careful man and an expert, as we know, at covering his tracks, his father may have said to him, listen, you know, you need to establish some kind of evidence that you were on a military base in Alabama. And so he went there and he went to the dentist.
Now, there was a medical exam he was supposed to take in Texas to see whether he could continue to fly. That one he was ordered to take and he never showed up for, right?
That's correct. I was going to come back to that. Wanted to establish the fact that he didn't do anything in Alabama.
Okay.
Because the whole reason that he left Texas was he was going to go manage a campaign. He had permission because he had an important job opportunity, which of course it wasn't, and that he had agreed he would go and he would serve in Alabama. And so what I'm saying is the dental exam appears to be nothing but cover for the fact that he just didn't show up at all in Alabama. Now, getting back to Texas, why did he leave in the first place? Well, I happened to interview the widow of the Alabama campaign manager. That couple were very, very close friends of George and Barbara Bush. And she told me that the reason that Bush actually came to Alabama, she says she knows this because her husband told her that, was that they received a phone call, panicked phone call from George H.W. Bush, Bush's father, saying that he was in and out of trouble all the time back in Texas and we need to get him out of here and will you take him in Alabama?
Now wait, can you give this woman's name? Is that a confidential source?
Not at all. Her name is Linda Allison. She's the widow of Jimmy Allison, who was the campaign manager.
Now, what you're saying is very strong stuff. I mean, you're saying that George H.W. Bush called Linda Allison's husband and told him that Bush had been in and out of trouble. We need to get him out of Texas.
Right. Well, Poppy Bush was basically Jimmy Allison's sponsor, you might say. They knew each other from Midland, Texas, and he had been a newspaper publisher, and Bush is the one who had gotten him into running campaigns in the first place.
Now,
so he pretty much listened to what he asked him to do.
Now, why would Linda Allison talk to you? I mean, you seem to be no friend of the president. Surprised.
Well, I mean, this is many years later, and you know, she doesn't hide the fact that she became increasingly disappointed, and I think she may have even characterized it as disgusted with Bush and what she felt was hypocrisy over the Kerry situation.
Has she gone public in addition to you in announcing this?
Yeah, she's given other subsequent interviews. Yes, you can read her interview with me. Go to the Wet Nation site; it's on there somewhere. It's called Why Bush Left Texas. You can also find it on my website, www.russbaker.com. It's somewhere right near the top.
Great. Okay, continue with the story.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was, so her explanation was the only reason he went to Alabama was that he had to leave Texas. So the question was, why did he have to leave Texas? How was he screwing up? Well, she told me that before those AP documents were released showing that he was having trouble flying. So now we find out that not only had his father asked that he be taken out of the state, but that the reason was that he was having some trouble flying. Well, what was that about? Well, we don't know exactly. Obviously, he has admitted, or rather failed to deny, he's admitted the heavy use of alcohol, but he's failed to deny the use of drugs during that period. He's been rather evasive about it. And so the inconsistency, the problems with his flying are significant. Now, we also know that he the year before had taken his annual required physical exam in May, in 1972, he didn't take that exam, and instead he took off. We have indications that they asked him to take his physical and that he declined and he left, which suggests that the reason that he left was because he did not want to or could not take his physical. Now, it's important to know that in that year, the military was beginning to introduce widespread drug testing as part of physical exams. Again, there's no absolute proof that there's any connection there, but there's no absolute denial either. And the other thing that's very, very important is that when he went to Alabama, he didn't take his physical either. He just didn't take a physical exam ever again for the military.
So, in other words, this is the very first medical exam. And we've reported on some of this in the past. We haven't reported on your very interesting interview with Linda Allison, which I find very interesting, where George H.W. Bush is calling up her husband, Jimmy Allison, and saying, hey, get my boy out of trouble. That's very interesting to me. We have reported on this site the fact that George Bush will not deny that he's used cocaine. He's denied he's used it recently. He won't talk about whether he used it in the past. And that was the first exam that had a medical test. But
right. Now, we learned more, actually, about this period, and that's a second article I wrote called Fear of Flying, and that is based in part on an interview with a woman who now lives in Florida, and she is the widow of a man we didn't even know existed originally. He is the fellow that when Bush left his unit in Texas, they needed to replace him. They needed to bring in another pilot, and a trained pilot. And she is the widow of the man who replaced Bush. His name is Jan Peter Linke. Now, Jan Peter Linke was a long time, he was a veteran of the Air Force, and he was at the time in the Florida Air National Guard. They brought him in, and he took the slot that Bush had. Now, she told me that sometime after her husband and she had moved there and he'd begun serving, they were at a social event, and they asked the commanding officer, who was also Bush's commanding officer, say, whatever happened to that guy that we replaced? And that she says that his reply was that the fellow that had been replaced, that is George Bush, had a problem with nerves and fear of flying, and that he attributed that to, in part, to what he suspected to be a serious drinking problem.
Now, what's interesting is that these nerves and fear of flying, I assume it was something that came up fairly new. I mean, the first years of Bush were, he got good reports that he was flying okay, everything was fine. I assume this is something that developed as time went on.
Yeah, I mean, this is only speculation, but, you know, for the first several years, he was in a full-time flying capacity, very intensive training, and, you know, flyers are known to drink, there's also a lot of control, and there's a lot of supervision, and they're living either on or near an airbase. But what happened in that latter period was that he basically became directionless, rootless, and he himself says that he really didn't have jobs. He lived at this very, very party-oriented swinging singles apartment complex, and he just really didn't seem to have a lot to occupy his time, and perhaps he spent it in a way that was not terribly profitable.
You know, what's interesting about this story is that people who would deny it and who defend George Bush, they don't go into the fact that George Bush himself has admitted at the end of 1972 that he was driving drunk, and of course we know he was arrested for that, but also that he threatened his father with a physical fight. He was taking his little brother, who was 16, out drinking. He was knocking down neighbors' garbage cans. I mean, all of this is admitted by George W. Bush. And so people that would suggest that, oh, well, he served fine in, you know, 3 months before all these incidents, really don't know, I guess, the full part of George Bush's life story.
Yeah, well, what's really staggering about this is that whatever you think of Kerry, he's being held to an almost impossibly high standard. In other words, it's not enough that he did serve in Vietnam in a free fire zone, and there's no question that he did, a highly dangerous situation, that he went to Vietnam and he served in an extremely dangerous situation. There's no question about that. There's no question that throughout his life, he's been an intelligent, active individual, participating fully in the civic life of his country, that in the Senate he attends meetings, he makes coherent, intelligent speeches, that he discusses critical issues and so forth. There's no question about that. And yet with Bush, the standard has been set so low. In other words, the mere fact that he's able to finish a sentence is seen as a major triumph.
I just think it's amazing. I mean, 6 months ago, I made a wrong prediction, and I admit when I make mistakes. I said, I don't think the Republicans will dare talk about Vietnam because obviously Kerry is a hero with a Bronze Star, a Silver Star, 3 Purple Hearts, and George Bush was not only using special favors to get out of Vietnam, he couldn't even finish his service with the Texas National Guard. He was high and apparently wasn't showing up. All these, and then lo and behold, they actually go after John Kerry. And as for George Bush, I actually think Nathan, who's one of the conservatives that writes in my program, I think he's got it right. He writes here on my blog, Mark, this is all very interesting. However, I think it will do little in the mind of the public. Most people view this issue as old news and already debunked. Even if this is true, the story has been effectively swept under the rug because of what Dan Rather did. No one will take this story seriously anymore. How do you address someone like Nathan, who is, I think, telling the truth, that even though this is true, and I have no doubt that it's true, Russ, I've looked at these documents myself, because Dan Rather used a forged document, no one's going to even take a look at this anymore.
Well, but you see, the spectacular thing about this is that we don't know that he ever used a forged document.
Okay.
We just don't know that. And in fact, there is some question whether those documents are real or not, but the interesting thing is, how did that ever get to be such a huge story? Has anybody discussed the provenance or the credibility of other documents? I mean, no one has. This again, is a classic, Rove-type situation.
Well, what's interesting also is that when these first reports of Bush using cocaine came out, they came out in a book by J.H. Hatfield called Fortunate Son. It came out before the 2000 election. And apparently, Karl Rove himself passed on, or through indirectly, Karl Rove never does anything directly with fingerprints on it, but passed on indirectly to this author that George Bush had been arrested for cocaine use, and Hatfield printed in his book, and then they spread the campaign that Hatfield had his own criminal record, and they got the whole book to be ignored, not because it was untrue, but because Hatfield had a criminal record, and then these issues go away. It wouldn't surprise me, and I said it before, if we find out 2, 3, 5 years from now that Karl Rove fed these forged documents, which I believe the documents were forged, but as the Killian secretary has said, the essence of them is true. There were similar documents. We just don't have the real ones. Fed these forged documents in a way that got to Dan Rather, and then it could discredit the whole thing. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a Rove dirty trick. That's my view.
Sure.
Let me just ask you, we only got a few minutes left. What do you think, if we could try to get anyone to reopen the story in any extent on George Bush being AWOL, what do you think is the most significant thing? One of the things I've discovered, and I don't know if you know anything about, is the fact that all the time Republicans are saying, well, he was honorably discharged, as if that solves everything. I've often mentioned that the Washington sniper who was AWOL during his National Guard service and also convicted of assault was also honorably discharged. But new documents that are actually on my website that come from Democrats.com and the work of Paul Dukasik show that he got this strange designation, PT-961, which if you go and you click on my site, suggests that it wasn't a particularly honorable discharge at all. It was basically just a way of getting rid of George Bush, and then it could be upgraded 6 months later to an honorable discharge. Can you say anything about that, or is that new information?
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about that personally. I did see that, and Paul has played an important role in this campaign, I think, in trying to help us understand some of these documents. The key thing, I think, about honorable discharges is that they mean very, very little, because one thing in the military is they don't really like to dishonorably discharge people. For one thing, a person's immediate commanding officers, it becomes a kind of a black mark on their record, and so they bend over backwards. Typically, if you look at almost any report or evaluation on a military person, they're exaggerated. If it says, literally, for example, there are categories like, I think it says, if it says that he is an excellent officer, that means that he's not very good, because there are levels above excellent. They're like superior or outstanding or something like that. And so honorable discharge doesn't really mean honorable. It just means that whatever it was not so unbelievably grave, and that there was no way at all that this thing, it wasn't likely that this thing was going to go public, and so they let the person go. That's really all that means.
I'd say an honorable discharge is kind of like getting an A through a D minus in school. You pass, but that's about all you do.
That's it.
Hey, Russ, thank you very much for coming here with your information on the Inside Scoop. I really appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you. When we come back, I'm going to switch topics and talk about new evidence on John Kerry. If you want to call in, though, you're always welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. But to me, just to finish up on George Bush, go to the website, click where it says click here, look for yourself, because new evidence is being discovered all the time to suggest that George Bush really wasn't given an honorable discharge in the sense of honor. He was given this very strange designation, PT-961, which more and more National Guard vets are saying it's a way to get rid of somebody. It's the way to get rid of somebody who's problematic, who's trouble, so they're never heard from again. Doesn't sound too honorable to me, and some are suggesting, in fact, that it really was a general discharge that only 6 months later was upgraded to an honorable discharge. Again, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. When we come back, I'm going to play at length excerpts from a Nightline broadcast, because I want to just get one last... We've taken one last look at George Bush. I want to take one last look at John Kerry. Nightline did a tremendous broadcast where they actually went to Vietnam to find out whether some of the stuff that John O'Neill and the Swift Boat Veterans for Bush were saying, whether it was true or not. It's an amazing story, and I'll also be able to give you some insight from some research that I've done on it. All of that and more when we come back.
You're about Bush. For a guy who brags about being a Texas rancher, George W. sure is stepping in a lot of cow patties with his Iraqi policy. There was that big one about needing to oust Saddam because he had weapons of mass destruction. He didn't. Then there was Bush's claim that the Iraqi people would throw kisses and rose petals at our troops. They didn't. But perhaps the slickest and stinkiest cowpatty that George has stepped in is his choice of allies to pursue his Iraqi adventure. By cozying up to regimes that are repressive and dictatorial, he has undermined any claim that his foreign policy is on the moral high road. In only 1 week in September, three of Bush's global buddies revealed themselves to be the very opposite of freedom fighters and democracy builders. First came Russian President Vladimir Putin, claiming, a la Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, and gang, that global terrorism warrants extreme measures. Putin unilaterally changed the way Russia's 89 regional governors and its legislators are chosen, effectively preventing opposition to his policies. Next was the Bush family's longtime pals, the royals of Saudi Arabia. Their use of religious police to repress Shiite Muslims, Jews, and Christians is so severe that even George's own State Department had to censure them, declaring flatly that freedom of religion does not exist there. Then there's General Musharraf, who stole democracy from Pakistan in a military coup 5 years ago. Ironically, Bush now hugs him as his close ally in his war to bring democracy to Iraq. Earlier this year, Musharraf pledged to give up his post as head of the military while also serving as president. Now, he has reneged, suddenly declaring that it's in the best interest of the nation that he wear both hats. This is Jim Hightower saying, America's credibility in the world is sinking because while George talks about democracy, he walks with autocrats.
Larry King here. You've heard me talk about Ester C. Well, now you can get more from your vitamin E. Introducing the advanced protection of Ester E. From the makers of Ester C, Ester E's breakthrough form protects its antioxidant strength until your body is ready to use it. So do what I do and get more from your E. Take new Ester E, E-S-T-E-R-E. Are you getting advanced protection from your vitamin E?
And now, look for new Ester E where fine vitamins are sold.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massage and gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, taking one last look at Vietnam. And I know that some say it's not relevant, but you see how this slam goes. What do? They say, don't look at what Bush is doing because Dan Rather got some forged documents. And, oh, we raise questions about Kerry. He may or may not be an honest man, but now we're ready to move on. No, you can't just whitewash Bush, raise questions about Kerry, and then move on. Let's just get the facts straight. What do we know about Bush? We know from the new evidence, and again, just click on my website. It's right there. Click where it says click here. And it goes in detail with the original documents to explain how the mystery of PTI 961, the designation that is the reason and authority for George Bush's discharge. And this website goes into length and explains exactly all the codes and shows how, in fact, Bush was discharged, quote, for failing to possess the required military qualifications for his grade or specialty, or does not meet the mental, moral, professional, or physical standards of the Air Force, unquote. Some honorable discharge. But I want to move on. I want to talk about John Kerry, because Nightline did an amazing piece just last week, going into John Kerry's most prestigious medal, the Silver Star. And, well, I'm going to let Ted Koppel explain to you the controversy over this. And then we're going to get to an amazing, astounding interview between Ted Koppel and John O'Neill, the guy originally hired by Richard Nixon to discredit Kerry, who's still doing it 30-something years later. And I'm going to give you some insight into that interview, because John O'Neill has really got his back up against the wall, and all he can do is point to two books. And I'm going to talk about how he's misused those two books. But let's start Let's start with the controversy. Let's start with Ted Koppel and the beginning of that Nightline broadcast.
John O'Neill, a leader of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
But the actual facts are that there was a single kid who had fired a rocket. The kid was wounded in the leg, and as he ran off, John Perry jumped off the boat and shot the kid in the back.
But there are some eyewitnesses who can shed light on what actually happened that day.
The Americans came from down here yelling, attack, attack.
I was now in a bunker, and when they climbed up, I told them, why am I bleeding out my mouth?
Nightline went to Vietnam to search for answers.
It was very fierce, and there was shooting everywhere, and the leaves were being shredded to pieces.
Tonight, what they saw one day on the river.
From ABC News.
Okay, so the essence of the charges. John O'Neill says there was a single guy in a loincloth, some teenager, some kid, that John Kerry shot in the back, and there was no other fire around. It was just John Kerry picking on this kid. That's John O'Neill's story. Listen more to the broadcast.
Should have been.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
But then came those campaign ads from the group calling itself Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
He is lying about his record.
Most of the charges were general. But John O'Neill, the officer who took over command of John Kerry's Swift Boat after Kerry left Vietnam, raised some specific questions about the incident for which Kerry received his most significant award, the Silver Star.
In the Silver Star incident, John Kerry's citation reflects that he charged into a numerically superior force and into intense fire. But the actual facts are that there was a single kid there who had fired a rocket who popped up, and John Kerry with his gunboat, with or without a number of troops, depending on who you talk to, plopped in front of the kid. The kid was wounded in the legs by machine gun fire. And as he ran off, John Kerry jumped off the boat and shot the kid in the back.
That's what this program is about tonight. The charge that John Kerry won his Silver Star for shooting a teenager who may have been a Viet Cong, but who was alone, not part of a numerically superior force, and who was already wounded and running away when Kerry shot him. There were a number of witnesses to the incident who've never been heard from before, who have no particular axe to grind for or against Kerry. Only one of them, in fact, even knew who Kerry was. These witnesses are all Vietnamese, still living in the same village where the fight took place more than 35 years ago. Life along the Bai Hap River in southern Vietnam has changed very little in those years. These are not really villages in the true sense of the word, just small hamlets, isolated shacks reachable only by boat. Surrounded by marshland, separated by winding canals, and concealed by thick walls of vegetation. If you travel an hour and a half or so up the Bai Hap River and make all the correct turns, successfully navigate the right canals, you'll come to the village of Trung Tui. The coordinates of the village are available to anyone in the after-action report on that battle. Finding the place is something else again.
Now, I can't play you all of the interview, all of the broadcast, but I'm going to play for you the heart of it. Listen to the evidence yourself.
According to Kerry's medal citation, the boats, quote, came under intense automatic weapons and small arms fire from an entrenched enemy force less than 50 feet away. Unhesitatingly, Lieutenant Junior Grade Kerry ordered his boat to attack. End quote.
Again, it's important to note that the Swift Boat veterans disagree with the official documented Navy accounts. And what Ted Koppel is doing is interviewing Vietnamese witnesses to see what they say occurred.
Nguyen Vong Quai says he also fought with the Viet Cong and has lived in this village since 1959. About 6 months ago, he says, he was visited by another American, a Swift Boat veteran with a cameraman. The veteran, he says, told him that another American from the Swift Boats was running for President of the United States.
They say he didn't do anything to deserve the medal. The other day, they came and asked me the questions, and I said, the recognition for the medal is up to America.
Nguyen says after they met, the Swift Boat veteran turned around and went back down the river. The fierce firefight at Trang Thuy was just the beginning of that day, which has become so central to John Kerry's biography. Waiting only 800 meters around several bends further up the river, concealed by dense undergrowth, was another Vietnamese soldier, armed with a rocket launcher. John Kerry and two of the Swift boats continued upriver. Our ABC News team took the same route to the site of the second deadly incident that day.
I do want to stop it just to say that I think it's very interesting that Nightline didn't get there first. It's quite expensive, quite difficult to go to Vietnam to find this place, to go through and use the after-action reports to find these very remote villages. And apparently someone supporting George Bush was there first, trying to convince a Vietnamese peasant to say, oh, well, John Kerry didn't deserve his medals. Listen to the way they phrased the question, telling him, John Kerry's running for president, don't you agree he didn't win his medals? ABC, on the other hand, asked a very open-ended question. And, of course, the guy didn't say it, right? The Vietnamese peasant said, you know, that's up to America. I don't know whether he got his, you know, medals or not. Instead, Ted Koppel asked very open-ended questions. Questions about the person John O'Neill says was a teenager that got shot in the back by John Kerry that was unarmed. Whether there were other Viet Cong, because John O'Neill says there was no other fire in the region. Listen on to Nightline's interview.
According to the Navy's official report, following the initial ambush at Trang Thuy, Kerry's boat, PCF 94, and another Swift boat continued up the river to an area where gunshots had been reported. Less than a kilometer upriver is Nha Vi, a small hamlet. Vau Vung Tam was a local Viet Cong commander during the war. According to him, the area was a hotbed of guerrilla activity. They had recently been reinforced by a 12-man unit armed with a B-40 rocket launcher. He says they had been dispatched from provincial headquarters specifically to target the Swift boats. According to Tam, there were at least 20 Viet Cong soldiers at Nha Vi that day.
There were 12 soldiers from the provincial level and 8 from the district level.
Bao TV, his wife, says February 28, 1969 is a day that the villagers of Nha Vi hamlet will never forget.
The fighting range from here all the way to the end of the canal. Everything was destroyed. There's no house left. They leveled everything. The fighting was very fierce.
According to the citation for John Kerry's Silver Star, when the boats approached the hamlet, and this is a quote, a B-40 rocket exploded close aboard PCF 94, that was Kerry's boat. He personally led a landing party ashore in pursuit of the enemy. Kerry's extraordinary daring and personal courage were commended for attacking a numerically superior force in the face of intense fire. That is disputed by Swift Boat veteran John O'Neill, who maintains in his book that the statement is simply false. There was little or no fire, he writes. Villagers say this is what they saw.
Firing from over here, firing from over there, firing from the boat.
Vaughn TV was only a couple of hundred yards away when, she says, a Swift boat turned and approached the shore. The boat was unleashing a barrage of gunfire as it approached.
I ran, running fast. I was pounding rice, and the Americans came from down here, yelling, attack, attack. And we ran.
Her husband, Tom, told us that the man who fired the B-40 rocket was hit in this barrage of gunfire. Then, he says,
He ran about 18 meters before he died, falling dead.
Was the man killed by John Kerry or by fire from the Swift boat? It was the heat of battle, says Tom, and he doesn't know exactly how the man with the rocket launcher died. But he does know the man's name, Bat Tan, that he'd been sent to the village by provincial headquarters, and that after he died, the firefight continued.
When the firing started, Bat Tan was killed, and I left Bat Tan's comrade, the whole unit, to fight back. And we ran around the back and fought the Americans from behind. We worked with the provincial soldiers to fire on the American boat.
According to the after-action report, after beaching the Swift boat, Kerry, and again this is a quote, chased VC inland behind Hooch and shot him while he fled, capturing one B-40 rocket launcher with round in chamber.
Okay, so there's pretty clear evidence that John O'Neill's lying when he said there was no other fire around. There was lots of fire. We've seen this not just from all the Vietnamese witnesses that Ted Koppel is having interviewed, but also from the after-action reports and also from every single person on John Kerry's boat, including someone that never spoke out before, William Rood, a Chicago Tribune reporter, who, when he found out all these lies, felt it was his obligation to let people know that they were lying. But what about the teenager? What about this little boy with a rocket launcher who John O'Neill says was all alone and was some teenager in a loincloth? What about him? Well, Ted Koppel explores that part of the story as well.
They have no problem remembering Bat Tan, the man who has been dismissed by Kerry's detractors as, quote, a lone, wounded, fleeing young Viet Cong in a loincloth.
No, this is not correct. He wore a black pajama. He was strong. He was big and strong. He was about 26 or 27.
Nguyen Van Thi says he didn't see Bat Tan get shot either, but he and his wife were the first to find his body.
When I came out and saw he fell right down there, I was going to run and pick him up. I thought he was sick or something. I tried to pick him up, but he was too heavy.
And now comes the most interesting part of the whole Nightline interview. The rest was really set up. It was really to let you know what all the interview is about. The rest is a battle, an interview, but I think it's more like a battle, between Ted Koppel and John O'Neill. As Ted Koppel confronts John O'Neill with all the evidence of the fact that he was lying, that there was fire, that there wasn't some lone gunman, that there was a Viet Cong hideout, that this was a danger, that John Kerry deserved the medal. Listen, as you listen to the interview, how John O'Neill repeatedly tries to change the subject. In fact, the first time he says, Ted, it's a shame you're not covering other stuff, like that incident where a small family was killed, or the two times that John Kerry fled, or the time he visited the North Vietnamese. Well, let me just tell you the facts on those, since it's not on the broadcast. The incident where a small family was killed, the Sampan incident, well, actually, according to every record and O'Neill's own book, there was a 12-year-old child who was inadvertently killed in the incident. It wasn't an entire family. But the dead child's mother and second child were rescued by Kerry aboard his boat. So, kind of different from saying a small family was killed. You actually have Kerry, after the child is killed, bringing the child's mother and the second child on his boat. In fact, O'Neill's own witnesses, Steve Gardner, the one person on Kerry's boat who has been against Kerry, all the other, more than a dozen, have supported everything Kerry said. Steve Gardner has said that Kerry tried to reprimand him because he was being too aggressive against the Vietnamese. He was shooting too much in the free fire. In fact, Kerry had to threaten Steve Gardner with a court-martial, and he's never liked John Kerry since. Even Steve Gardner has never disputed these facts. So, again, when O'Neill tries to change the subject, keep this in mind. As far as fleeing two times, even, again, O'Neill's own witnesses have denied these claims. So every one of these stories is phony. I don't doubt there may be a picture of John Kerry as well as other Vietnam protesters in the North Vietnamese Museum. which is not exactly something that John Kerry can do anything about. But listen to how John O'Neill keeps trying to change the subject. The other thing he does, he keeps trying to mention two books which he claims support his claim. At the end of the broadcast, I don't want to interrupt the interview, at the end of the broadcast, I'm going to tell you the research I've done into what's in those two books. Now let's listen to the contentious interview between Ted Koppel and John O'Neill.
John O'Neill served in the U.S. Navy from 1967 to 1971. He took over command of John Kerry's Swift boat in 1969 when Kerry left Vietnam. He is a leader of the group Swift Vets and POWs for Truth, and the author of Unfit for Command, a book that calls John Kerry's record in Vietnam into question. As I mentioned to you before the broadcast, Mr. O'Neill, we're just going to have time to focus on the one issue that we have looked at tonight, that is the Silver Star issue. And if I can just begin... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, may I say, Ted, that's a real shame. It's a shame that you focused only on the one minor accomplishment of John Kerry and refused to ever cover the Sampan incident where the small family was killed, the two times he fled that are described in the book, and
Mr. O'Neill...
Or the time he visited the North Vietnamese.
Mr. O'Neill, you know, maybe we're going to be able to do something more. This was the place that we were brought to.
I invite you to, sir.
This is the place we found. Let me, though, just for this evening, ask you to focus...
It's the third time you've covered it.
Let me ask you to focus on the issue at hand. And the first question I have is the sort of intriguing question about who that Swift boat veteran was, who talked to that one Vietnamese, former Viet Cong that we heard from this evening, who said he raised some questions about John Kerry, said this guy was running for president, said he had won awards that he did not deserve. Do you know who that was?
It was no one from our group, Ted, and if anybody implies that it was, it isn't the truth. Ted, John Kerry is in the North Vietnamese War Museum as a hero. He's honored by them as one of the heroes who caused them to win the war in Vietnam.
Mr. O'Neill, I understand. I mean, forgive me for interrupting you. I understand you have your agenda, but if you'll be good enough just to, if we can just address the questions first. You say you don't know who
he is. Your report is unreliable.
Well,
he went to a country where all the elections are 100% elections, and you relied on people that were enemies of the United States in a closed society instead of getting the information that was easily available from us and from the record, and as a result, you produced a report that is truly pathetic.
Mr. O'Neill, I don't think you can complain about not having received enough coverage over these past few months. You've received a ton of it.
Not on night.
My question has to do with what eyewitnesses to the event. I mean, you can impugn them any way you want to, and I have no way of vouching for their motives or their interest in either supporting John Kerry or doing damage to a group that, like your own, that I'm sure they've never heard of. Why is it that you are so reluctant to at least address the substance of what they said? In other words, you make it clear.
I'm thrilled to address the substance. Let's go right to the substance.
Let's get to it.
This is the book had published by the Boston Globe. This is their autobiography of John Kerry with his assistants. Ted, in their autobiography, they describe on page 101 a single teenager in a loincloth, Ted. They weren't trying to make it up. This is John Kerry's own approved biography, Tour of Duty. On page 296 of that book, John Kerry says, boy, he's glad there was only a single person there and not more. What you've done is go into a closed society instead of interviewing direct witnesses.
Mr. O'Neill,
and produced a story that isn't even the story in his biography,
Mr.
or that
O'Neill,
of the Boston Globe.
We have other pieces of evidence, including the after-action report and, of course, the citation to the Silver Star itself, which talks precisely about a superior enemy force. You're the one who raised questions about the superior enemy force. It appears from the recollections of the Vietnamese who were on hand at the time, they recall a superior enemy force, 12 soldiers from, forgive me, if you'll put the book down, we can't read it anyway, so
Ted,
all you're doing is sort of reflecting white light back. Yes. So?
Ted, this is the biography by the hometown newspaper of John Kerry.
It says there was a single Viet Cong teenager in a loincloth.
I asked the author of it, Micah Kranich, how did you get that information?
And he said, I got it because that's what everyone told me. It's the same information I got. In John Kerry's autobiography, the same information appears,
Mr.
except
O'Neill,
that they don't give the age.
You're being
now,
repetitive.
Really?
I am referring to what you wrote in your book and asking you to respond to what you have just heard from a bunch of people who do not seem to have... we got the title, Unfit for Command. Just do me a favor. Stop picking up books. And let's see if you and I can more or less look at one another and just get a few questions and answers back and forth. You wrote that there was only one man, and in fact you didn't describe him as a man, you described him as a kid. You described him as a kid in a loincloth.
That's not true. Then.
Turns out he was 26 or 27 years old, was sent by provincial headquarters, was a leader of a 12-man Viet Cong unit that was sent to that place, and I am simply giving you what the folks on the scene described in order to ambush American Swift Boat. Why do you have trouble accepting
it? I have a lot of trouble, Ted, because you went to a country that is a closed society. You ignored every single report. You've ignored the written biography of John Kerry by the Boston Globe that concludes exactly what we did. Michael Kranich, who interviewed American after American, including Kerry's crewman. You ignored Kerry's own autobiography, Tour of Duty, in which he says he was glad there was only a single gunman. Let me suggest that when we have a choice between Kerry's crewman and our crewman all saying there was a single person, the people, you never interviewed our guys, of course, but his people and ours saying there was a single guy popping up and a group of Vietnamese who were opponents in the war living in a closed society, you've made a very strange choice to go all the way there and pick them.
Do me
you
a favor.
Made just a strange choice.
Just explain
it's
to
the
me.
Same as
just explain to me, if you can, why you think it is that a bunch of peasants in a truly remote part of southern Vietnam would have an interest in making up stories that would somehow benefit John Kerry and raise questions about your version of that particular incident. What motive could they possibly have?
The first thing I can tell you for sure, Ted, is that their story is totally different than Kerry's story. It's totally different than
You've mentioned that, but I mean, try and answer my question.
Now,
I've heard you say that three times.
The marvelous new discovery in Vietnam occurs in a closed society in a country that has honored John Kerry himself as a hero in their war museum who helped them win the war. You could see the government personnel directly with them. I guess if I have a choice, Ted, between relying, as I did, on the Boston Globe autobiography, on Kerry's own autobiography, on his crewman, on your prior show that you had in July, which said essentially the same thing, and on the recollection of the guys that we had that were there, or a group of people coming up with a totally new story in a closed society, I choose to rely on Kerry's books, Kerry's crewman, our crewman, and the other sources. I don't think it was worthy of you all to go and go and interview these people and try and impeach me without bothering to look at the Boston Globe autobiography, at Kerry's own book. The story is ridiculous, first of all. Kerry didn't go in the first assault. Everyone says that the initial two boats went in. Kerry milled around, and then a rocket was fired at Kerry. Kerry's boats turned in towards the shore, and we have said that Kerry's action involved some courage, and he deserved some medal. But the fact of the matter is, when he turned in, Ted, only a single Viet Cong popped out of that hole. He was wounded in the legs by a machine gun.
Mr. O'Neill,
Kerry chased him. That's what everyone says, Ted.
I've been very patient listening to you give the same rendition of the same story three or four times now. But one thing you have not...
It's in everybody's book, Ted.
I understand which books it's in. It's also in his citation for bravery, for which he won the Silver Star. It is also in the after-action report, Mr. O'Neill. So
it's not as though...
The only thing that I find really fascinating about this is that you seem so reluctant to admit that it is possible for a bunch of peasants in South Vietnam, we've never heard of this man before, to independently, in somewhat varying forms, to confirm the essence of what John Kerry claimed about the incidents that led to his Silver Star.
that's not true. Ted, we accepted John Kerry's version of the Silver Star. We just pointed out that his version, which is a single guy popping up out of a hole being shot in the legs, is not a numerically superior force.
Nor is that what we suggested tonight. We're saying that the single guy popping up out of the hole who was wounded, who may or may not have been killed by John Kerry, was not the end of that battle, that there were 20 other Viet Cong on the scene, according to the eyewitnesses.
Well, what John Kerry says...
The interview continues, and my time is about up. Let me just say that what John O'Neill says, Ted Koppel, you haven't read the two books. I have. Not the two books entirely. I'm thankful to DailyHowler.com for giving me the excerpts from the two books. And what do they say? Well, Michael Cranish points out in the book that John O'Neill is holding up in his hand that the U.S.-led forces routed more than 20 B.C. Viet Cong from their spider holes and entrenched positions. Gunfire was erupting from Viet Cong forces along the shoreline, and 10 Viet Cong had been killed. There's no mention in there that the guy was alone. Now, I should state that I have done research. In one Boston Globe article, there is a reporter that talks about a teenager in a loincloth. That report is not only contradicted by John Kerry's crewmen, including William Rood. It's not only contradicted by the Swift Boat veterans, including Stephen Gardner. It's also contradicted by the Vietnamese that we've seen in Ted Koppel's broadcast. It's also contradicted by the after-action report. So it's a perfect example of taking one line, and then he says, oh, it's Kerry's hometown newspaper. Well, you know what? The Boston Globe can make a mistake. What he goes on to say, though, is that in Kerry's approved biography, that was Kerry's version of the events. Let's listen, and let me explain how you take something out of context. We turn to Brinkley's book. All right, we turn to page 296, the exact page that John O'Neill shows up. And what does it say? It quotes Kerry as writing in his journal for March 1st, 1969. Here's what he writes. As Kerry saw it, he'd simply been lucky that the Viet Cong rocket had missed his swift boat and that he had fought quickly enough to beach it and kill the assailant. He could not stop wondering. Instead of one Viet Cong with a B-40 in the spider hole, what if there had been 3 or 5 or 10? He knew the answer, of course. In all likelihood, Western Union would have been delivering death notices to the families of the men under his command, not to mention to his own parents. In other words, John Kerry was saying, what if more than one Viet Cong had a B-40? More than one Viet Cong had a rocket launcher? Kerry wasn't saying there was only one Viet Cong there. He was saying, what if there had been more than one Viet Cong with a rocket launcher? What if 3 or 5 or 10 had rocket launchers? Then they would all be dead. It makes perfect sense. But now you see how O'Neill uses a quote after context to say, Kerry says there's only one person. His biographer says there's only one person. And I only wish that Ted Koppel had read the books that John O'Neill was flashing up on the screen so he could say to him, look, everything you say, John O'Neill, every book you throw up there isn't true. Your accounts of Kerry's crewmen isn't true. It's just not there. And so it's a very McCarthy-like technique. I did a research project years ago on Joe McCarthy where I looked at one of his books. And he had lots and lots and lots of footnotes. And I started to check his footnotes, and every single one of them was false. And if you listen to people complaining about Kerry, what they'll say is, okay, you got me on this one, but then there's this, 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 and this, and this. And you just have to go piece by piece by piece and show that each and every comment they're making is a lie. Joe McCarthy used to hold up a laundry list of 296 names that he claimed were communists in the United States government. And when they'd find that 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 or 12 names weren't communists, he'd say, yes, but there's 280 others. It takes patience to go through each and every one of these lies. I hope we don't have to discuss this again. It is sad. It is really sad that these attacks are why John Kerry is only tied in the polls. But I wanted to give this broadcast so that you can tell your friends if there's anyone who says, well, you know, but